My name is Alfred Dupuy. I was a member of the USS Pollux. Ms. Brown, I enjoyed the telephone conversation, and I've received your letter. I'll endeavor to answer some of these questions. I'm not never having done this. I probably am going to have a lot of organized confusion, but you just bear with me and use whatever I tell you as you see fit and discard the rest. My name is Alfred Dupuy. I had joined the Navy the August before. I was 26 years old, really an old man, as I found out. I got orders to a receiving station in Norfolk, Virginia. I did not go to boot camp. I just waited on orders. I didn't know a square knot from a granite, and still don't, as a matter of fact. Well, at any rate, I got orders to go to the USS Pollux. I'd never been aboard a ship. Ladders to me were stairs, bulkheads were walls, and I felt like a lone ranger when I got aboard and found out that a lot of folks had the same problem I had. So at any rate, the only way I can do this is I'll start from the crash, and I'm sure I'll wander and wharf on tangents and that sort of thing, but just bear with me. That was a nasty night. I understand that all their guns were frozen. They'd even secured the gun watches. And it was a storm, miserable, snowing, sleeting. At any rate, we had this tremendous crash. Matter of fact, so much so it threw me out of my bunk, and of course General Quarters sounded, and I remember saying to myself, "Oh Lordy, this is no dry run." Well, there was organized confusion down in cruise quarters, everybody trying to get topside, meeting on ladders and that sort of thing. But anyhow, it was confusion, but it's somewhat organized. I got topside amidships, and it was indeed a sight to see. They had the searchlights on, playing on the cliffs, and my God, bleak, nothing. Rocks, waves, white caps, waves, high as a building, slamming up against the reefs. And it was a escape, really. We couldn't go above amidships because of the fourth part of the ship was underwater and was really breaking up. You could see it. It was my understanding that we were aground on the port side and with 300 feet of water on the starboard side. And of course, nobody knew when the ship broke up whether the after part of the ship would slide off that reef or not. And it's something to think about. But at any rate, it did, it broke up. I've forgotten sometime in the morning. And it broke right at number two hole. That was where my office was. Really, I had charge of the material in number two hole. And a funny thing, a couple of days before, I'd washed my skivvies and I'd hung them up in the hole to dry. And yeah, before God and everybody there, my skivvies were waving. There's some humor in it, I expect. But at any rate, there had been efforts to try to get a line ashore by various people, which I'm sure you have an account of, but to no success. When the ship broke in half, it ruptured the diesel oil tanks or whatever oil type of oil they use, and it was spread on the water. Well, the captain, I think some of the people asked him, I don't know, but the captain did not order abandon ship. The captain, as I understand it, gave his permission for anybody that wanted to try to make sure to go ahead. And I will say it looked so easy. It wasn't that far. Not really. But it turned out it wasn't easy at all. Some of the men climbed down cargo nets, and some of them slid down ropes to make sure. Some of the people apparently had forgotten to tie their tie ties on their life jackets, so around their neck, so when they slipped in the water, the life jackets slipped up, raised their arms, and they're dead. And some of the men got currents carried them into that oil slick, and when that happened, they just disappeared. They were dead. So these waves kept pounding the after part of the ship, and the ship would shift, and it was tilted pretty good. And I finally decided, after one real good shift, that I said, well, I told Fred Brim, I said, Fred, I'm gone. So I climbed up to the rail. It was angled pretty good then, and slid down a rope that was attached to a raft. I've forgotten there's four or five people in the raft at the time. As soon as my feet hit that water, I knew I'd made a mistake, a bad mistake. My God, it was cold. But I looked longingly up, but no, there was no way I could climb back up that rope, so I just dropped in the raft. So then we gonna cut the line loose and take off for shore, we thought. Well, to start off with, there was some question about if anybody had a knife. Well, we finally found a knife and did cut the line and got a couple of paddles and took off, paddling like crazy. Well, we'd get about halfway to the shore and then the currents would catch us and take us back to the ship. And then we'd start out again. And we'd almost get there, then the currents would take us back to the ship. I wasn't getting anywhere. So I finally, I said to anybody in general, I said, hell, I'm gone. So I left the raft, and it wasn't a question of swimming. You couldn't swim, not really. A wave picked me up and carried me on in and tossed me up on the beach. It could just as easy have picked me up and slammed me up against a rock, I reckon. So at any rate, it left me there, and I remember looking up, and some people had made it on this reef before me, and I said, men, give me a hand. They just looked at me. Well, that made me mad. Mad enough where I got enough energy to crawl, and I could hear the wave back of me coming back in, and I think that had a hell of a lot to do with me getting up out of the reach of the wave. So we were a miserable looking lot, full of grease, oil, and coal. I'd lost my shoes, and there's no way, we were just there. I looked back at the ship, and hell, they sure did look warm. I sometimes wondered whether I'd made a good decision or not. But at any rate, to my left, there was a big pond, a basin, natural basin, about chest deep of water, and a number of men had been tossed into that pond, about chest deep, as I say, and they were crying for help and wanting a line, throw me a line, and what the hell. Well, no line to throw. I assumed that they were too weak, too cold to even try to wade to the reef. So I assumed they died. Now, on the other side of the reef, let me see if I can explain it. There was a narrow ledge that led from our reef across to another reef that really jutted out towards the ship. And if you could get to that reef, you could probably get a line. Well, the only problem was it was a real narrow ledge, and snow, of course. And if you lost your balance, you're dead. It's just that simple. But nobody would go. So I said, well, hell, I'll go. So I started, and I got on my hands and my knees. I'd put a hand down in front of them and push down. I was afraid, what I was afraid of, that there would be crevices or holes in hell. I'd step, and I'd be gone, but I could feel it. And as I crawled, so I crawled across the reef and edged down the reef as far as I could go. I looked ahead of me. I could have gone a little further, but it was a solid sheet of ice and then the ocean. Well, I wasn't fixing to go any further. So they threw me a line. It was obviously a small line to start off with, and I kept pulling and pulling, and it got a little larger. And I remember I threw my head back and put my hands to my mouth, indicating a drink of whiskey would be fine. And they sent me some over. I got it, but my hands were so cold and I was so weak I couldn't get the top off. I started breaking on a rock, and I said, "Well, no, no, no." I said, "With my luck, I'll probably drink some glass and die. Hell, I've done come too far for that." So by that time, somebody else had traversed the, I guess that's a good word, negotiated, I guess, that little narrow ledge, and gave me a hand, and we pulled over the line, so it got to be a rather big line, really. And we tied it around this great big boulder about 16 times, and I didn't know how to tie a square knot, and so help me God, we tied a granny knot, three or four granny knots. And then they started this bridges board. They sent, the first man they sent over to test it, I guess, now he was the hero for my money, it was a big devil, an ensign, I've forgotten his name, weighed a couple hundred pounds. And he made it. And then they started sending them over, one at a time. And it was a long, laborious thing. And then meanwhile, somebody had given me some shoes and socks. So that helped some. So we were all milling around. It's an all-day operation. I can't really remember. But I think it started midday. I've forgotten. Well, anyhow, night was falling. And then we found out that the damn reef was underwater at high tide. But there was no way up the reef. No trail, no nothing. I'm sure that cliff wasn't but 20 or 30 feet or 40 feet maybe, but to me it looked like it was 400. But about nighttime, when night was falling, this head appeared over the cliff, hollowed down, and another head. And it was in the Falmouths that actually we found out they'd been busy rescuing the trucks and all that day, what few people were saved on the trucks, and then they came to get us. So it was a question of just pulling everybody up one at a time. And on that reef, I never will forget it, there was a slush hole about, knee deep, I guess, full of slushy snow. And I'd be damned if I stepped in that thing once. I stepped in it 30 times, enough to make me, damn near cried. But at any rate, I guess because I was one of the first that they pulled up the line. And when we pulled us up over that cliff, oh my God, it was black, dark, and that's when you could feel the wind. You couldn't feel the wind down on the reef. The wind was howling, and they had people to guide us. Otherwise, it would have been really easy to just walk back over the cliff. Guide us to this fire, and that they had built that scrub pine. Wasn't much of a fire, but it was a fire, and we all sat around it as they'd come up one at a time. Cold, my God, it was cold. And I remember we ate snow, and that's not any good, of course. That doesn't quench your thirst. But I remember I had a can, I don't know where the hell a can came from, and I filled it with snow, and I put it near the fire and very carefully watched it melt so I could have some water, and then I got somebody and knocked it over. And we had so much for the water. So sometime during the night, unfortunately, I had better sense, a group of them wanted to try to make the village. I started to, and I said, no, I don't think I will. So I sat back down at the fire. And then Subsequently, they did make the village. They lost, I think, one man. He had one more hill to go over, but he couldn't make it. LaRosa, I think his name was. I've forgotten now. The baker. But anyhow, that night, the doctor, there's nothing the doctor do. Some of them died around the fire from exposure, I guess, and or whatnot. But that morning, here comes some sleds. Men with some sleds. And I don't remember whether I was the first, second, or whatever, but they strapped me in the sled and took off to the village. Well, they apparently were not, as I remember, were not really from that village. And I tell you the truth, there's just nothing but snow and snow and snow as far as you could see. Well, they headed out, and they got on a hill, and I can remember them arguing among themselves which way to go. And I thought to myself, my God, to come this close and then freeze to death. It didn't hardly seem fair. So at any rate, we did get to this little village. I've forgotten its name. I really don't know. But it was a mining village, and they took us in, stripped clothes off of us, and fed us some hot food and gave us some old clothes. At the time, I don't think it rang a bell, but they were desperately poor people, really. I don't know what the government ever did for them, our government, that is, but whatever they did for them wasn't enough. I think one of the things they did was to build a hospital later on. But anyway, they gave us whatever food they had, and they didn't have much. And the clothes, old clothes. So later on that day, they took us to a ship and took us up to Argentia, where the USS Prairie was, that's the destroyer tent, also where the base was. And that's that. I don't remember going to the dispensary. Maybe I did. I just don't remember it, really. I remember next day, a couple of days after that, going in a makeshift morgue to try to identify people, and that was real discouraging. I didn't do so good on that deal. But anyhow, I was a storekeeper. I don't know what I said. That's not right. I was a storekeeper, and so several of us, storekeepers and yeomen, set up an office and started processing whatever you do, the forms and this and that. There were lists to make up and survivors and this list and that, hundreds of lists to make up and so forth and so on. So I stayed there. I've forgotten now. 5-6 days, I think, maybe a week, I don't know. Some of the rest of them they took down to Boston. But we stayed because we had this work that we were doing. So I finally was put aboard a ship and sent to Boston. And I was very, very reluctant. As a matter of fact, I slept on the top. I didn't go down below decks. I was afraid to, really. It's still sort of fresh in my mind. But we made Boston, and then of course we were the Pollock Trucks and Wilkes unit for the various and sundry boards of inquiries and whatnot. So that is, roughly speaking, what happened. Now I've got some. Of course, I guess. I was cited for bravery, and I got the Navy Marine Corps Medal, and I was given a commission. I think my rescue work had a great deal to do with that, and all that was that's nothing compared to the fact that I lived, and it wasn't easy. But there's some things that I would be interested in, and gossip, I don't know, because I was a listed man at the time. I understand that through negligence or just maybe not through negligence, but anyhow, when we all hit, it was put out over the wireless in clear language. And therefore, hell, the Germans knew the same time Washington knew. I don't know if this is true. It's interesting. But I was not involved in the Board of Inquiry. And while it was going on, of course, they kept us as a unit. I got my commission as an ensign in the Navy and was ordered to the U.S. Navy Market Office in Boston, where I spent the rest of the war. And I assure you, I did not volunteer for any more sea duty. There are some things that have always puzzled me, and maybe you have the answer, and if so, maybe you let me know. It was rumored that Lieutenant J.G. Grantley, who was the navigator that night, pleaded with the captain to change his course, that the course was wrong that the SOPA set. I would be interested in that. Also, Grantley was Naval Reserve. He was had his master's papers in the Merchant Marine. Matter of fact, he'd had a ship. And of course, he was called up when war was declared and made a JG. And rumor has it that they were going to make him the GOAT. But he's from South Carolina. But he goes home on leave, and a friend of his, a very good friend of his, was a member of the Armed Service Committee. So this chap, he does allow that if they try to crucify his constituent, Grinley, that he'd bring the sorry mess of the Pollock, Strux, and Wilkes fiasco on the floor of the House of Congress. Now that I would be interested in. I don't know if it's true or not. But also, what always puzzled us is, where was the Navy? They knew when we hit 4 o'clock in the morning. Now, where in the hell was the Navy from 4 o'clock in the morning all that day and all that night? We got no Navy help. Why? That's always puzzled me. Christ, I'm sure they knew where we were. But it's just one of those things, I suppose, but things like that interest me. If Grinley's still alive, and like I say, I don't know what happened to the man. He was from South Carolina, Lieutenant J.G. Grinley. If you hadn't contacted him, you should, because he, I'm sure, would have an interesting story to tell. That's about all, I guess. It was a trying experience, really. I don't really think that I took it seriously enough, and perhaps that's the reason I made it. I don't know, because any man in his right mind would be scared to death. I guess I was scared, but I didn't take it as a joke. But I sort of took it sort of in a sort of detached way. I guess I don't know, but. But anyhow, I'm not very good at describing a man that had a proper use of words could describe that scene, and it was that scene at that wreck. It was something. It reminded me of Dante's Inferno, really. But I don't have that good a command of descriptive words. But it was something else again. Now, if I can be of any other help to you, Ms. Brown, let me know. I tried to call you other day, last night, as a matter of fact, to talk with you. But hell, I couldn't even find you through information. Apparently Brown, this ever Brown's up in St. John's. But at any rate, so I thought I'd go ahead and do this and send it to you. And if you need anything else, if I can help you any other way, if you will call me, I'll write me. I'll endeavor to do it for you. I guess I enjoyed reliving this. It seemed like it's 100 years ago, and you know, it never was. Christ, I fought, got recalled in the Korean War. They needed a lieutenant supply corps like they needed a hole in the head, but I was in the active reserves. So I, to end the story, I went to drills and got my points every year. And when I turned 60, believe it or not, I got the pension. I'm getting, grossing $500 a month, every month. And I swear, it sure is nice. So I guess my staying in the Navy, I ended up, incidentally, a lieutenant commander. And it was a rewarding thing, really. So now I'm retired. Now I'm drawing the pension. I've been very fortunate. I own a company, president. I'm president, really, and chief majority stockholder in a company here in Birmingham, a delivery service company, and I'm making a very, very fine living. After many years of being a bachelor, I married a young lady from Oklahoma City, as a matter of fact. And so I'm very happy, extremely happy. Like my Marianne said, my wife, she says, modest you're not. So I don't know. We're going to spend Christmas down in Austin, Texas with her daughter. She's got a grown daughter, she's a practicing lawyer down there. I'm going to fly down. I can't leave my business till a couple days before Christmas. I'm going to fly down and join her, so I'll be gone till after the 1st of January. Again, thank you for giving me this opportunity. I ran the tape to be sure that what I said was audible. And you know, it doesn't really seem like a big deal just listening to it. But I assure you, I guess it was. But there are two things that happened, one humorous and one not very humorous, I think I ought to mention. And that is, when I was thrown up on this reef and climbed up out of the waves, out of the reach of the waves, one fellow I talked to, I said, have you seen Fred Brim? That's Fred was the boy that was storekeeper that worked number two hole with me. And this fellow said, yeah, he didn't make it. I said, oh my God. And he grinned, and Jesus Christ, it was Brim all the time. I couldn't recognize him with the oil and whatnot on him. So much for that. Now the other thing, as I mentioned, this reef that everybody came over on was underwater at high tide. And I understand, I was safe around that roaring fire, if you will. But I understand that the only officer we lost was Ensign Clark, I think he was his name, and about five men. They had the water, if the tide was coming in, the water was swirling around their knees, or so I'm told. And big wave came in, and they'd all joined hands. And it swept Clark and all the men out to sea, and somebody was telling me this. And all you could see was the bobbing of the lights, and then nothing. That's, for whatever it's worth, almost they made it, didn't they? Anyhow, that'll about do it, and like I say, Ms. Brown, that's a million years ago.